Welcome back. This is The Streets Were Paved with Gold, part one of a journey through the Jewish Lower East Side of New York, part of the series Only in America, 350 Years of the American Jewish Experience. I'm Larry Josephson.
The vast majority of immigrants to the United States came under the age of 40.
Tony Michaels teaches American Jewish history at the University of Wisconsin.
Most immigrants were young. 25% were under the age of 14.
For the most part, we did play in the street. We played school, we played potsy.
I remember playing potsy, you know, getting a can, you know, and would put it out on the trolley tracks. The trolley would go over and flatten it out, then we would have a potsy. You would draw boxes and you would hop and push the potsy from one box to the other.
Because American life is, especially in the big cities like New York, so much hurly-burly in the streets, there were so many temptations, there was organized crime, there were corrupt people trying to tempt or cheat or do something to lead people astray. I mean, this was all part of daily life.
Allen Street was dark because the elevated railroad ran overhead, and so this was the red light district.
Annie Poland, education director at the Eldridge Street Synagogue Project.
And the saying was at the time that if you walked through Allen Street and someone called out to you, you knew you were not being asked to join a minyan, a prayer quorum. The prostitutes on the Lower East Side were Jewish, and I believe 25% of all the women arrested for prostitution in New York in 1917 were Jewish, and that's about the population of Jews was 25%.
Steve Long from the Lower East Side Tenement Museum.
There's a lot of discussion among reformers about housing or fair labor practices or how to, you know, in their terms, sort of Americanize these newcomers.
Between the German Jews and the East European Jews, there is an enormous socioeconomic chasm.
Historian Kenneth Lebo.
The German Jews had come a generation before. They were already totally assimilated. But nonetheless, they felt a social responsibility toward them, and they created magnificent institutions to hasten the Americanizing process.
Annie Poland.
Probably one of the most important of the people advocating social change who came outside the neighborhood was Lillian Wald, who started an organization called the Visiting Nurses Association because many of these people crowded on the Lower East Side did not have health care.
The child led me through broken roadways, past evil-smelling, uncovered garbage cans, through a tenement hallway into the sick room. All the maladjustments of our social and economic relations seemed epitomized in this brief journey, and what was found at the end of it. The family to which the child had led me was neither criminal nor vicious. Although the sick woman lay on a wretched, unclean bed, soiled with a hemorrhage 2 days old, they were not degraded human beings, judged by any measure of moral values. Lillian Wald, The House on Henry Street, 1915.
Lillian Wald received funding from Jacob Schiff, an uptown Jew, to open the Henry Street settlement.
The settlement houses were terrific. There was always something to do. You learned how to sew if you wanted to.
The idea was that you would have people from the outside coming to kind of, I guess, settle the wilderness of the Lower East Side.
We used to go to the Educational Alliance. We called it Edgies. It used to be on East Broadway.
The Educational Alliance was a place that the Jews could be Americanized. They could learn English. They could learn about art. They could have a library.
Educational Alliance socialized me. It introduced me to the world because I didn't know much about the outside world.
Certainly, reformers come with a very particular perspective, which doesn't always jive with the perspectives of the people that they're ostensibly trying to help.
Housekeeping notes. How to furnish and keep house in a tenement flat. a series of lessons prepared for use in the Association of Practical Housekeeping Centers of New York, 1911.
Reformers always complained about how much furniture tenement dwellers had. Apartments always look so cluttered.
Suggestions for furnishing. A few good pictures add a great deal to a home. It is better to have these on the living room wall. If it is desired to have pictures in the bedrooms, a sanitary way is to paste the prints on the painted walls and wash them over with liquid shellac.
We would be appalled if somebody came in and said we had too many tchotchkes in our homes, but reformers were regularly complaining about that.
On the Lower East Side, there were over a half million Jews by 1910, 1912. The closest competitor in Europe was Warsaw, with about 300,000 Jews.
It was a very cruel system, and there was no social safety net other than the net that the immigrants made for themselves.
Jewish immigrants, when they arrived in the United States, turned to fellow Landsleit, or people from the same town that they came from in Eastern Europe, to help them in times of need.
This building right here is, if you look at the very top, you can see it says established 1892, the independent, the D is missing, Kletsk Brotherly Aid Association. Kletsk was a town in Poland, and this was their Landsmannschaft.
Annie Poland.
A Landsmannschaft was a hometown association, and there were thousands of them in New York in this time period.
So let's say you're off the boat at Ellis Island and you walk into the Lower East Side. If you're from the town of Kletsk, you know you can go in here, see people you know from your hometown.
And they would then help you find a job, help you find a place to live.
If you got sick, they would help take care of you. If you died, God forbid, part of the membership of the Landsmannschaft gave you a plot in their cemetery ground.
Jewish Daily Forward, January 17th, 1914. Vilna, Minsk, Berdichev, Homel, each of these cities and towns is represented by New York cafes. Go down a few steps off the sidewalk and there's Minsk. A few more blocks and we're in Vilna. One feels at home in these Landsleit cafes. The ocean and America notwithstanding, a familiar plate of barley soup in the basement of Vilna, Volkovisky, Shavel, or Kurenitz brings you back home.
Younger Jews were less interested in where they came from than where they were going, less interested in shared geography than shared ideology.
Not only do we need a trade union, fellow workers, we must also organize a union where workers and their families can care for one another. A brotherhood where workers share the same ideals, serve the same goals. One for all, and all for one, in a ring of friendship. An arbiter ring.
And so in 1901, you get the organization of the Workmen's Circle. The Workmen's Circle drew Jewish immigrants who were committed to socialism, who considered themselves free thinkers.
Later on, the immigrants who formed these social safety net societies had enormous influence with people like Al Smith, people like Franklin Delano Roosevelt. I'm not saying that there would have been no New Deal without the immigrant Jewish experience, but it certainly contributed to it.
Tony Michaels.
We're talking about the largest, most compact Jewish population in the world. It was predominantly poor and working class. So there was this vacuum. In the Jewish case, the vacuum was filled by radical intellectuals who came to the United States by the hundreds, perhaps the thousands, starting in the 1880s. So all of a sudden you have, as leaders, as spokesmen for the community, people like Abraham Kahan.
He was born in Lithuania and came here as a 20-year-old in 1880. and his head was filled with ideals.
When he saw the conditions of Jews on the Lower East Side, he decided that he needed to start speaking Yiddish.
Many of the immigrants didn't have a need to learn English on the Lower East Side. They could speak Yiddish to their neighbors. They could speak Yiddish to the pushcart peddlers.
What can you make of this America? So you land of fifties, you can say. What can you make of this America? I feel it, there is something for me to go.
He created what would become the largest circulating Yiddish newspaper in the United States, with a circulation that reached over 200,000 by the 1920s.
This was the Jewish Daily Forward, or Forwitz, one of the many Yiddish newspapers published on the Lower East Side. Isaiah Scheffer is artistic director of Symphony Space.
The newspapers were on every spectrum of left to right and every spectrum of religious to unreligious.
The Forwitz was a social democratic paper, and the Freiheit was a communist paper. But in addition to that, you had papers like Der Tag, which was the New York Times for people who couldn't read English. And you also had the Morgen Journal, which, unlike the Freiheit, the Forwitz, and Der Tag, was a religious paper.
Kahn was maybe the greatest figure in that world as editor of the Jewish Daily Forward.
Kahn was not at all ashamed to use any method that would entertain his readers so that he would be able to give them his socialist pitch.
On the front page of the Forward, one issue, they had a baseball diamond so that you could learn how to play baseball. So on the one hand, you know, this was a socialist paper. On the other hand, it was about Americanization. It was how to get a job and how to fight for your rights as an American.
Immigrants would come in and badger him with all kinds of questions. Will I die if I eat a tomato?
May a woman wear rouge?
Is the Irish school teacher trying to convert my children on the sly?
Is it okay for a socialist to go to Rosh Hashanah services or Jewish New Year services? So, of course, these ask provocative questions ranging from the frivolous to the very serious to elicit readers' answers. And this was so successful that in 1906, he put together the Bintel Brief.
A Bintel is just a bundle, and a brief is a letter, a bundle of letters. It would be like a letter to the editor column seeking advice about situations in life.
Here is a letter dated February 27, 1906. Mein teurer Redakteur von Forwitz, ich lese jeden Tag mit größter Aufmerksamkeit die Zürich von Familienleben in einer Bintelbrief. Dear Mr. Editor of the Forwitz, I read the troubles of family life in your Bintel brief each day very attentively, but my own troubles are so great, so enormous, that I will not even ask your permission to print my few words in your paper as others do, but simply I ask you right on the spot, help!
Dear editor, I recently met a fine girl. She has a flaw, however, that keeps me from marrying her. The fault is that she has a dimple in her chin, and it is said that people who have this lose their first husband or wife. I love her very much, but I'm afraid to marry her lest I die because of the dimple. I've questioned many people. Some say it's true, others laugh at the idea. Perhaps you too will laugh at me for being such a fool, but I cannot rest until I hear your opinion about it. Respectfully, the unhappy fool. The tragedy is not that the girl has a dimple in her chin, but that some people have a screw loose in their heads.
Worthy editor.
Dear Mr. Editor.
Dear Mr. Editor.
Dear editor.
Dear editor. I am one of those unfortunates who for many years has suffered from the Voelkes disease. I am the father of a three-year-old girl. All who know my child hug her and kiss her, but I may not. I know this all too well, yet I can't keep myself from kissing my little girl. This bothers me more than the suffering from consumption, because I know I am infecting my innocent child.
I am a 28-year-old woman, married for 6 years, and my only trouble is that I have no children. My husband eats my heart out with a few words, like rust eats iron. He keeps saying it's nearer than farther to the 10-year limit, when according to Jewish law, I will have to give him a divorce if I don't have a baby by that time. Dear editor, can my husband get a divorce after the 10 years through the court, too?
You can't read these Bintel briefs without realizing the hardships and the emotional tugs of daily life.
These immigrants were not turning to rabbis. They were not turning to wealthy people in the community. They were turning to a newspaper for advice on how to figure out how to be a good American, a moral person, a decent person.
I thought the majority of people in America were Jewish. It didn't even dawn on me that somebody else around until, of course, I got older. We had one storekeeper who was not Jewish, and he closed up on the Jewish holidays because he said there's no sense of staying open. He wasn't going to have any business.
Historian Annie Poland.
At the turn of the century, probably about 70 to 80% of the Lower East Side was East European Jewish. The rest were Irish and Italian and non-Jewish Poles. But a lot of times people, they remember the neighborhood was all Jewish, and that wasn't true. One of the ways to kind of point that out is that people always remember having a Shabbos goy.
On the Sabbath, when you wanted them to turn off the gas or turn on the gas or whatever, or the lights and all, you had what they called a Shabbos goy. That's somebody who was not Jewish, so he came in, and he made his living that way, because he, at the end of the Sabbath, he was paid whatever, there was a dime or a nickel or so, because you couldn't find anybody otherwise who would be able to do that.
You crossed Eldridge Street, and the streets running north and south. You were in a foreign country, an Italian country, and there you didn't hang around. You had your boundaries, and they had theirs. They weren't the best friends of the Jews at the time. If you went to the north, when you went above Housen Street, over to First Street, you were now in Russian, Polish, Ukraine territory, and you didn't bother over there either.
Hungarian Jews tended to live above Houston Street. The Russian Jews tended to live around East Broadway. The Romanian Jews around Orchard Street. One of my favorite Bintel briefs was one in which a woman writes, I am a Russian woman, and my daughter just married a Hungarian, and now she's putting on airs.
Now that she's a first-class Hungarian, she laughs at the way I talk, at my manners, even the way we cook. I therefore want to express my opinion that Russian Jews and Hungarian Jews should not intermarry.
"1910, dear editor, I ask you to decide whether a married woman has the right to go to school 2 evenings a week. My husband thinks I have no right to do this. I admit that I cannot be satisfied to be just a wife and mother. I am still young, and I want to learn and enjoy life. My children and my house are not neglected, but I go to evening high school twice a week. My husband is not pleased, and when I come home at night and ring the bell, he lets me stand outside a long time intentionally and doesn't hurry to open the door."
Kenneth Lebo.
The role of the husband and the wife were reversed in the new country.
Annie Poland.
In Eastern Europe, the married women did work and their husbands could be scholarly and studying.
In the old world, in the shtetl, the husband would have a place of honor in the synagogue. In the new country, the woman now held on to her status. The husband would have to give her the paycheck every Friday because it was her responsibility to stretch the money out until the next paycheck.
These women were very different from their mothers and in some cases very different from their daughters.
These Jewish women were also ready to go out in the street and to protest.
Deborah Dashmore.
In 1902, you have Jewish housewives protesting the price of kosher meat, going into butcher shops and boycotting them and taking meat if someone has purchased it and even throwing kerosene on it so that it would not be edible.
There was a column every day in the Jewish Daily Forward called Missing Husbands.
I am looking for my husband, David Siletsky, the butcher from Puzanim. He is 35 years old, blonde, of mediocre height, with a round, fat face.
Juppe, juppe, meiner, juppe, juppe, meiner, gib kein Trick zu mir.
There was, I guess you could call it an epidemic, of husband desertion, in which fathers and husbands would leave their families.
The sister-in-law of Shlomon Kahan from Slonim is looking for him.
And this was something they could do given the anonymity of large urban life.
Whoever knows about him should contact Zuckerman at 7 Orchard Street.
In a large part, you can look at the chaos of daily life, of having to support your family, as a factor explaining husband desertion.
This is, of course, an enormous tragedy among the observant Jews, because the only way a woman in Orthodox Jewry can get a divorce is if her husband grants her the divorce. But if your husband is a missing person, then you cannot get a divorce.
My great-grandfather came to the United States in the 1880s. He spent 6-7 years working as a grocery store owner, and he was pretty happy, so much so that he seemed to be making no effort to bring his wife and children to join him. Finally, the townspeople where they lived decided that this was an embarrassment, that this woman and her two sons had been, in essence, abandoned. And so they raised the money to send her and the sons to the United States. She comes and she discovers that, lo and behold, he has a grocery store not on the Lower East Side serving Jews, but a grocery store in the Italian section. And he had, of course, pork products. And she was distraught and she made him give up the store. My great-grandfather probably would have been perfectly happy if his wife never had joined him. Later on, his wife became ill, became convinced by this specialist that she had very short time to live, and she abandoned her family, leaving him with two young sons and my grandfather, who at that time was just about to turn 13.
Historian Deborah Dashmore.
This kind of family disruption, while not necessarily typical, was certainly widespread. Immigration had its costs, and when we call Jewish immigration to the United States a family migration, we're putting what may seem to be a very happy, smiley face on something that was emotionally wrenching and reverberated on individual lives in very severe ways.
Worthy editor, I am sure that the problem I'm writing about affects many Jewish homes. It deals with immigrant parents and their American-born children. We, the five brothers, always speak English to each other. Our parents know English too, but they only speak Yiddish. Imagine, even when we go with our father to buy something in a store on Fifth Avenue, he insists on speaking Yiddish. We are not ashamed of our parents, God forbid, but they ought to know where it's proper and where it's not. We beg of you, friend editor, to express your opinion on this question, and if possible, send us your answer in English, because we can't read Yiddish.
Of course, the first word my brother learned was, get out of here, because that's what he heard in the streets.
I started school 2 weeks after we came here. I was 10 years old, and they put me in a 1A. And I came in, I know no English, and the teacher told the class to stand up. I didn't know what she was talking about, and she came over with a metal ruler, and she whacked me across my arm. I got up very quickly, and I also realized that I would have to learn English very quickly, too.
1907, worthy editor. There are 7 people in our family. I am the oldest child, a 14-year-old girl. My father, who is a frail man, is the only one working to support the family. I go to school, where I do very well. But since times are hard now, and my father earned only $5 this week, I began to talk about giving up my studies and going to work in order to help my father as much as possible. But my mother, she didn't even want to hear of it. Mother and father work very hard, and they want to keep me in school.
You did not have the feeling that things weren't going to get better. Imezras Hashem, with the help of God, you were going to make it. But besides the help of God, you knew also that education was going to be your road out. It was always stressed, the education. That's why you came to the United States.
This ends part one of A Journey Through the Jewish Lower East Side of New York. We've heard excerpts of oral histories from people who lived on the Lower East Side at the turn of the 20th century. We've also heard from Annie Poland, Education Director at the Eldridge Street Synagogue Project, Steve Long of the Lower East Side Tenement Museum, Isaiah Sheffer, Artistic Director of Symphony Space, and from historians Kenneth Lebo, Tony Michaels, and Deborah Dashmore. In part two, Becoming Americans.
The conventional wisdom held prior to 1909 that Jews made good strikers but bad trade unionists. It took more than 2 decades for Jewish workers to get their act together so that they know how to run and maintain a union.
People were coming to the Yiddish theater after long days at work. In the year 1900 alone, over 2 million people went to the Yiddish theater.
You've been listening to The Streets Were Paved with Gold, part one of A Journey Through the Jewish Lower East Side of New York. It's part of the series Only in America, 350 Years of the American Jewish Experience. To hear this program or others in the series, and for information about podcasts, CDs, and transcripts, visit our website, onlyinamerica.info. Send your comments to only@radioart.org. Our readers were Jerry Stiller, Barbara Rosenblatt, Isaiah Sheffer, Oliver Wyman, Fritz Weaver, Jasmine Petraru, Stacey Brass, and Zero Mostel. The series was developed, written, and executive produced by Larry Josephson for the Radio Foundation. This program was produced by Larry Josephson, Sarah Elzis, and Sarah Peratt. It was edited by Sarah Elzis. Our script consultant is Paul Fisher. Marty Goldenson is our resident radio doctor. We had help from Sarah Kramer, Adam Goodkind, Franny Carr, Eleanor Ostrinsky, Rosa Goldenson, Maisie Tivnan, Raylan Grogan, and Diana Green. Our historical consultant is Dr. Jonathan Sarna. The interviews were recorded by Bill Sigmund and Robert Auld. Post-production by David Rapkin and Robert Auld. A very special thanks to Nikki Newman Tanner. Thanks also to the Ellis Island Oral History Collection, the Temament Library at NYU, the Pittsburgh Jewish Oral History Project, the DeRoe Jewish Division and the Performing Arts Division of the New York Public Library, the Judaica Sound Archives at Florida Atlantic University Libraries, the Unite Here Archives at Cornell University, YIVO, the Eldridge Street Synagogue Project, and the Lower East Side Tenement Museum. Thanks also to Bob Gill, who designed our logo, Rich Conaty of WFUV's The Big Broadcast, to my assistant, Deborah Sotopoulos, and to Andy Lancet, who runs the WNYC Archives. This series is made possible with grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the National Endowment for the Arts, because a great nation deserves great art. Additional funds from Saul and Stanley Zabar in memory of their parents, Louis and Lillian Zabar, Russian immigrants who founded Zabar's more than 70 years ago. Zabar's, a New York landmark, supplies food and delicacies to New Yorkers and to the nation. On the web at zabars.com. Additional support from Edwin A. Goodman, Harvey and Thelma Reisman, the John L. Loeb Jr. Foundation, from Frost, Zelnick, Lehrman, and Zissou, specializing in intellectual property law for clients worldwide. On the web at frostzelnick.com. And from one anonymous donor. This is Larry Josephson.
This program is distributed by the WFMT Radio Network.